May we please have appearances in State versus Mark Jackson and State versus Jamie Monroe?
Tamar Y. Lehrer, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, representing both Mr. Mark Jackson and Mr. Jamie Monroe.
Good morning. Alexander Shalom, and today I'm representing the ACLU, the ACLU of New Jersey, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors, and please forgive me for not standing. This is Special Deputy Attorney General and Acting Assistant Prosecutor David M. Liston appearing on behalf of the state.
Good morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Sarah C. Hunt on behalf of the Attorney General.
Is the quality of the sound all right for everyone?
Yes. Good.
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Lehrer, please go ahead.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Your Honors, I'm going to first address the statutory argument and then discuss the constitutional argument. But before I do either, I would like to very briefly touch on what's at stake at this case. What we're talking about are the calls made every day by the 8,000 pretrial detainees in New Jersey's jails. Calls in which pretrial detainees and their loved ones are discussing everything in the wake of their lives falling apart. Custody, housing, jobs, mental health. There's so much private content at stake here. The only question in this case is whether to access all this private content, the prosecutor's office needs to comply with the Wiretap Act and the Constitution, or if it can just access this content at any time that it so desires. So I'm going to begin with the Wiretap Act because there's a preference for resolving the case on statutory grounds if possible. So the Wiretap Act protects phone conversations in storage. Simply, these are phone conversations that have been stored, and they're entitled to the Wiretap Act's protections. Specifically, the way the Wiretap Act protects these conversations is by prohibiting interceptions of wire communications. So there's two questions here. Is the prosecutor's office getting the calls an interception? And are the calls a wire communication? The answer is yes to both questions.
Do we get beyond the question of whether this is an interception? And I just want you to walk us through whether the Wiretap Act addresses this, because if an interception is a communication acquired through use of any, quote, electronic, mechanical, or other device, and if that quoted phrase does not include equipment used by law enforcement in the ordinary course of their duties, such as the officials at the jail, then is this an interception within the meaning of the Act altogether to be addressed?
Yes, for two reasons. So my fundamental position is that there are two interceptions in this case, or rather one non-interception, which is what the jail is doing, and one interception. So there are two reasons that I believe that what the prosecutor's office is doing is an interception, even though that's not what the jail is doing. The fundamental concept here is that the prosecutor's office act is a separate act that cannot be bootstrapped off of what the jail is doing. So the plain language of the word intercept in the Wiretap statute is to acquire, and the prosecutor's office plainly acquired the contents of these calls. First it did not have them, and then it had them.
But are they acquiring an interception?
Yes. So they have to, the federal kind of line of cases that the AG relies on says, once the jail gets this conversation, because what the jail is doing is not an interception, it's freed of all of the strictures of the Wiretap Act. It has no strings. But I think we don't have to accept that reasoning. We have a different act that is stricter than the federal act. And I think based on the interplay of A17 and A2, it wouldn't make any sense here to adopt that reasoning. A17 creates the conditions under which a law enforcement agency that was reporting these calls in the ordinary course of its duties can choose to share this information. It can do so to the extent that the disclosure or use is appropriate to the proper performance of official duties. If what the jail was doing, recording this call, created a non-interception that then had no strings anywhere else, it wouldn't make any sense for A17 to exist.
So you're going to the exception. Why don't we start with the basics, the definitional language in 2D1, which speaks about equipment being used by an investigative or law enforcement officer in the ordinary course of his or her duties. Is that an impediment in this case?
That is only an impediment in this case if the prosecutor's office gets to piggyback off of that definition, off of that exception.
May I ask you a question about that? You're saying that, and I'm not asking you to concede this, but you seem to be saying that the corrections officers getting the recording is not an interception, or at least you're not contending.
I do concede that.
Okay. So you're saying that the prosecutor's office getting the recordings makes what would ordinarily not be an interception. That's your argument.
My argument is that what the jail is doing is not an interception, and nothing that happens afterwards changes the jail's right to do this. What I'm saying is that when the prosecutor's office, that it's a separate entity, wants to acquire these recordings not in the ordinary course of its law enforcement duties, which is what is allowing the jail to conduct these recordings, but to conduct a separate criminal investigation, that's a separate interception. That's an actual interception.
But that's an acquisition by grand jury subpoena. Are you saying that any time a prosecutor's office reaches out and gets recording data through a grand jury subpoena, that even though it has nothing to do with an interception when it was originally made, it becomes an interception because a prosecutor now has it? That's pretty broad in terms of the implications of that.
That is what I'm saying. I'm saying that these conversations in general, the wire communications that are stored here, are protected by the Wiretap Act. And while the jail has special access under 2D1 to record these without any cause, that exception doesn't extend to any separate investigations that a separate entity is conducting and the separate information it wants to harvest from these stored communications.
So you have a constitutional argument, of course, that you'll get to as to what the prosecutor must present in order to be able to acquire the contents of the communications. But to bring it under the statute, you have to satisfy the definition under C. And intercept is not simply acquiring contents. It's acquiring contents of communication through the use of electronic, mechanical, or other device. How do you satisfy that last part in light of the language in D1?
Well, so a wire communication is any oral transfer made in part or whole through the wires, right? And any storage of that communication.
Of that communication.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So while the original conversation that the jail is reporting is, the jail kind of gets a freebie here. Then when these conversations are stored, they are now in a separate category of stored electronic communications. And if the prosecutor's office wants them, our position is that it has to go through the Wiretap Act.
Are those two separate categories, as you've just described, or is it that you've got intercepted communications in Category 1 and then stored versions of intercepted communications? So if that's the case, I don't know how you can create a second category if you don't begin with an intercepted communication to begin with. Please.
Well, so our position is that the wire communication that is not intercepted because of AD1 is one thing that already occurred. But then any electronic storage of a communication that the Wiretap Act is protecting is entitled to the Wiretap Act's protections. And again, I think our most compelling point on this case is the existence of A17, the existence of limits on what jails, when and how they can share the information that they are acquiring. If there were no limits on these communications, the jail could just give them out whenever it wanted to, or the prosecutor's office or anyone else could demand them in any form. But A17 says very clearly when a law enforcement officer in the course of his duties is intercepting a communication, he can only disclose it under certain conditions. So that subsection, which has to mean something, because that's the rule of statutory interpretation, wouldn't make any sense if after the call is lawfully recorded, those recordings are then free from any limitations at all.
Why isn't it not logical to read the statute in this way? You can't intercept, and you can't hand over intercepts that have been stored?
Again, because what leaves us with A17 that says...
You're getting to the exception now. Start with the, please, if you could, start with the language of the statute, not the exception.
Yes. Well, our position, as the position of the trial court was, as well, is that generally phone communications are wire communications. They are an oral transfer made in whole or part to these facilities. The behavior of the jail is exempted from the definition of an interception. But the statute is still asking us to look at when entities are acquiring communications that have been made through the wires and stored versions of those communications. And our position is that it's indisputable that the prosecutor's office obtained a stored phone conversation that it didn't have before. So what the jail is doing, which is allowed under AD1, does not exempt these calls from all protections from all other entities.
Well, I'm trying to understand your argument. You're saying that the original interception was lawful by the correctional officials?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so forget about the storage piece. Then if we're looking at 156A-17A, it talks about disclosure, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
It basically says that one law enforcement agency can that lawfully obtains a wire intercept can disclose that information to another law enforcement agency that's conducting an investigation, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why isn't that what happened here, particularly since there was the issuance of a grand jury subpoena?
Well, because the disclosure of intercepted communications discusses the conditions under which an law enforcement officer that has obtained knowledge of the contents of a wiretap can choose to share this information. But in this case, the people at the jail did not learn of the contents of the communication and make a decision using their judgment, as is required in subsection A, appropriate to the proper performance, etc., to share this information. The prosecutor's office demanded the information, and that's a different question here. I think we would be in a significantly different position if the jail was listening to these calls as they were happening, or even to the recordings of these calls, and then made the decision to divulge what they were.
Why isn't it a stronger... Look, 156A-17A says that one investigative agency can share information with another, may do it. Why isn't it a stronger argument for the state that they have a grand jury impaneled that is subpoenaing the information from an agency that is in lawful possession of the wire intercept? Go ahead.
So if the phone calls that are in storage are protected wire communications, there's no legal way for the prosecutor's office to access them without a wiretap order. There's no limit. There's no different tiers of protection under the Wiretap Act. That's not the case in the constitutional argument, which we can address when this court is ready, but I think here we kind of have a really binary situation. Either the recorded calls are protected by the Wiretap Act or they're not. And if they are, a wiretap order is necessary, not a grand jury subpoena.
Tell me if I understand your position. The corrections officers could lawfully intercept. That was not an unlawful interception, right? But when the prosecutor's office, and I'll use your word, demanded copies of those lawfully intercepted conversations, that demand itself was an interception?
The obtaining of the calls on the basis of that demand was an interception.
Okay. Thank you.
That's our position.
Do you want to address the constitutional argument? If there's more you want on that point, feel free. But if not, go right on to the constitutional argument.
If your honors have any questions about storage, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'm happy to move on to the constitutional argument. So the constitutional argument. Our fundamental position is that the pretrial detainees here have a reasonable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the prosecutor's office, even if they do not have any reasonable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the jail. So that comes from Hempel and a line of bedrock cases in New Jersey that say you can have different expectations of privacy as to different categories of people. So I think the first step here is to examine why the pretrial detainees don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the prison. And that's because of the institutional needs, sorry, the jail. That's because of the institutional needs that the jail has in order to function. That a reasonable expectation of privacy in your phone calls is essentially incompatible with the institutional needs of the jail. But that is not the case with the prosecutor's office. And the prosecutor's office is not acquiring these conversations to further the institutional needs of the jail, but actually for a separate function of the facility of criminal investigation.
So your argument is there may not have been a reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, let me ask you first. Is there a reasonable expectation of privacy for a pretrial detainee who is warned in a couple different ways, as the record indicates, you have two different cases, that calls other than specific calls, such as calls with a lawyer, are going to be monitored and recorded? Does that pretrial detainee have a reasonable expectation that his or her calls will remain private?
So I think that, with all due respect, there's a few things mushed in there that we kind of need to separate out.
Okay.
I think first we have to ask, does a person generally have an interest in keeping their calls private? That's the first question under Hempel. I think then the question is generally, kind of as a category or class, the same way this court looks at standing questions, can pretrial detainees have any reasonable expectation of privacy in their calls ever? Or is the very fact of their confinement in the jail mean that they cannot have a reasonable expectation of privacy? And then if there is a potential reasonable expectation of privacy, then I think the question is, based on the warnings that they got when they chose to make a phone call, were they consenting to that recording? And were they consenting to all the disclosures that happened with the recording?
Well, let's use Mr. Jackson as an example. Let's just assume the facts are, as the state alleges, that he signed an inmate telephone ID number release form that stated telephone calls are subject to monitoring, recording, and may be intercepted or divulged. Use that as an example. If he saw it, does he then have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his telephone calls?
Again, I think it doesn't necessarily matter extremely whether this is a question of waiver or whether this is a question of reasonable expectation of privacy, insofar as what you are told to do, what you are told and then you make a decision can lower your reasonable expectation of privacy. Yeah. But I think the reason the consent framework is helpful and important is because it reminds us that consent is based on the terms of the agreement and the scope as a reasonable person.
And just to be clear, I'm not talking about whether he waived any right, but whether he does, even if we assume he doesn't consent or leave that aside, being informed of that fact, your telephone calls are subject to monitoring, recording, and may be intercepted or divulged, does he then have an expectation that when he next gets on the telephone with someone other than counsel, he will have that conversation will remain private?
So the question is, what would a reasonable person think that this agreement means? I think, very tellingly, when you look at the contract he signed, it says this is an agreement between Mark Jackson and the Essex County Correctional Facility. I think it is reasonable to believe that a detainee in his position would understand that the jail is monitoring his calls.
What about the word divulged? Divulged is there. I mean, that tells you...
That the jail may make the decision to share these calls if the jail feels the need to. But I don't think any reasonable detainee would look at this agreement and say, oh, if the prosecutor's office wants to conduct a criminal case against me, they don't need to get a warrant anymore. I don't think anyone would understand that that's what this means.
Even though he's told that they may not only be intercepted, and here's a familiar word, but divulged.
Yes, and again, whether it's looked at, the consent framework is just helpful because it reminds us to think, but it's the same way with the reasonable expectation of privacy, is what would a person take the behavior of the jail to mean? Why would a reasonable person think the jail is recording his calls? And what does he think that process otherwise to investigate him criminally entails? So a reasonable detainee looks at this agreement, hears your calls may be monitored or reported at the beginning of the calls, and thinks, okay, the jail, for jail purposes, for security, to protect detainees, to protect guards, the jail has rights. And if the jail chooses to act on what they hear here, that I was warned about. But I don't think any reasonable detainee looks at this and hears that warning and says, oh, the prosecutor's office, if they want to prosecute me, they don't need judicial process anymore.
So you're suggesting that if the jail got a call from the prosecutor who said, listen, we think this jail inmate is suborning perjury, is threatening witnesses, is running his drug operation outside the jail, can we get his recordings? And the jail says, okay, we'll send him over. That's okay, but the subpoena without the jail's prior consent is not?
I think if the jail made the decision to hand over the tape because they were listening to these calls, that might be okay, that would likely be okay, but I think any form of the prosecutor's demand needs to be met with,
all right,
let's go get a warrant.
Let me take it the next step. Jail gets a call from the prosecutor's office and says, hey, listen, take a look at these calls. See if for any of them support our investigation regarding his subornation of perjury, his threatening witnesses, or his drug activity outside the jail. If they do, will you send them over? Is that okay?
No. And I think maybe another example would maybe help illuminate this. So let's say a victim of a sexual assault reports to the police, to the prosecutor's office, my assailant had a tattoo on a sensitive area that can only be revealed by a strip search. The prosecutor's office calls the jail and says, hey, you guys have an unfettered right to conduct strip searches out of concerns for institutional security. Can you strip search everyone in your facility for us and look to see if they have this specific tattoo on the sensitive area of their body? That would be unreasonable because the jail's right to access this private sphere is conditioned upon the jail's needs to run its institution. It doesn't mean that other law enforcement agencies can use the jail and their special access to private information to harvest information about a criminal.
Isn't there a difference under the law if the prosecutor's office asks the jail to conduct a search as opposed to the jail doing it on its own?
Yes. And in this case, when the prosecutor's office says, give me your calls, hand them over to me to try to get around the protections that would otherwise be attendant to these calls because the jail has special access, is a very similar problem and violation.
Let me give you this hypothetical, because you basically pivoting off of your strip search. A pretrial detainee is brought to the county jail, and in the ordinary course, he changes from his street clothes into prison garb, and as that's occurring, the corrections official notices a gang tattoo and just puts it on an ordinary report, a certain gang tattoo. If the prosecutor requested the form where the corrections official was taking down information about the person's name, place of birth, and also observations about his physical makeup, could he, under those circumstances, turn over information about the gang tattoo?
The jail is receiving a request from the prosecutor's office.
Yes, the corrections department didn't conduct a strip search. They made an observation in the ordinary course as this person was going from one garb to another. So they obtained the information lawfully. Could they lawfully then turn that information over to the prosecutor's office pursuant to a prosecutor's investigation?
I don't think so. I think it's a closer call. I think what's important when we think about the way law enforcement agencies...
Why wouldn't they be able to do that? Under those circumstances, does a pretrial detainee have an expectation of privacy that what is seen on his body won't be transmitted to another law enforcement agency?
I think if the jail is getting access to viewing someone's naked body because, as the jail, they have certain needs that allow them to get that access, other law enforcement agencies can't bootstrap that special access in order to conduct separate criminal investigations.
So let's make it a little, let's make it a little less intrusive. Suppose the jail has a policy to read incoming and outgoing mail for security purposes, which most jails do. Prosecutor's office gets wind of the fact that there may be evidence related to a criminal matter. Can they request it? Can they issue a grand jury subpoena? Or must they get a search warrant? And if so, explain the expectation of privacy and its reasonableness.
My position is that they need to get a warrant to read the contents of private letters. I think a few things are important here. I think
private letters that everybody knows are going to be read
by the jail.
Yes.
So I don't think I can emphasize enough two things. The first is what everybody knows who's a pretrial detainee. They know that the jail is reading their letters. Actually, there's three things I think I can't emphasize enough. So let's start with that. What the detainees know is that the jail is reading their letters. The second thing I think I can't emphasize enough is that we're here, just like we are always here in Article 1, Paragraph 7 cases, because there is some criminal activity that's been discovered, but Article 1, Paragraph 7 doesn't exist to protect criminal activity, it exists to protect privacy. And what we're talking about in these conversations or in letters are the contents of these incredibly private conversations, and most of them, the overwhelming majority of them, are innocent. In Jackson, when thousands of calls were received by subpoena, we're talking about thousands of really intimate communications. And the third thing I want to emphasize, and the ACLU did discuss this more in their brief, but what's at stake is this associational act, this critical associational act. There's a right to privacy on one side, but also a right to speak to your loved ones on the other side, and especially in situations where people are in jail for months pretrial. And for instance, right now, my understanding is that visits are no longer allowed at the jail. This is a lifeline for all of these detainees who are presumed innocent, and they are waiting to get out. So I think it's easy to minimize what's at stake here when we're thinking about a few conversations that do have evidence of criminal activity, but we have a much broader issue here, which is when can the prosecutor's office get all of this stuff, this incredibly intimate, incredibly important stuff from people who are stuck, and this is really one of their only lifelines while they're in jail. And then, of course, there's the people that they're talking to, which this court in Catania discussed how the innocent callers, A, their privacy is always being intruded upon when these calls are being monitored, but B, they might not ever know the extent to which their privacy has been invaded. So the callers, for instance, know, they hear the recording, your call is being monitored or recorded. But again, a reasonable person thinks by the jail for jail purposes, not the prosecutor's office can get thousands of the calls I've had with my fiance without any judicial process whatsoever. I don't think anybody in this case has shed their expectations of privacy to that degree.
Anything else you'd like to present?
I'll just sum up by saying that the ultimate question under Hempel is whether, if acquisitions of jail calls are unregulated by constitutional restraints, the amount of privacy and freedom remaining to citizens would be diminished to accomplish inconsistent with the aims of a free and open society. And I think in a free and open society, where people who are presumed innocent are in jail for months and months and months at a time, to ask the prosecutor's office to, if not get a warrant, go through any kind of judicial process, any kind at all, before obtaining thousands of calls for hundreds of cases. We see through Monroe, through Jackson, and other cases in the prosecutor's brief, they are doing this regularly. This is bulk collection of the most private information that pretrial detainees have left, that there should be some sort of process to get the prosecutors access to this. So the calls in this case must be suppressed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lehr. We'll have you back on rebuttal. Mr. Shalom.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm going to confine my comments to the constitutional issues, and I'd like to make three major points. The first is I'd like to point out what a radical rule it would be to say that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in the phone calls that emanate from jails. Second, I'd like to explain why the rule that this court has established in Hempel and a long line of cases is not altered by the fact that both corrections officers and prosecutors are law enforcement officers. And finally, I want to explain why nothing short of a warrant supported by probable cause would achieve the purposes of Article 1, Paragraph 7. So if I may start with the first piece about the appellate division's holding that prisoners in jail have no reasonable expectation of privacy in their phone calls. The state proposes essentially two rationales for abandoning the well-settled principle from Katz that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their phone calls. The first is that the calls are known to be monitored, and the second is that jails are different. And so I'd like to take those in turn. First, that the calls are monitored. We know that many of the phone calls that we make, particularly to businesses, are monitored. And our assumption, the assumption that society holds, is that they are monitored for a limited purpose. Sometimes when we call a customer service agency, they'll say, this call is monitored for training and whatever, supervision purposes. And other times, they won't. They'll simply say, this call may be monitored or recorded. When I call Netflix to get help with my account, I might expect that the call will be monitored or recorded for various things. But what I don't expect is that a website will go up explaining the shows that I'm currently binge watching. I also, and critically here, don't expect that if the prosecutor's office wanted a list of every person who streamed the movie about Edward Snowden, my expectation is that they wouldn't be able to get that from Netflix with no process simply because I knew that the call had been recorded. That is not what society is prepared to expect as reasonable. Then the question is, well, are things different in jails? And the answer is both yes and no. They are different to some extent. We allow jailers to conduct searches to maintain the orderly and safe operations of correctional facilities. But that doesn't mean we give them carte blanche. To be clear, in Florence v. County of Burlington, which was a United States Supreme Court case about strip searches, five former attorneys general of New Jersey took the position that people maintain an expectation of privacy when they're in jail, and that the strip searches at issue there were unreasonable. That's not the position that the United States Supreme Court took, but that is the position that those five amici former attorneys general took. It can't be that when you go in under New Jersey jurisprudence that entering the jail means you lose all reasonable expectation of privacy. Ms. Lehr talked about strip searches, and we know that strip searches are permissible under certain circumstances, though we have a statute that limits it. But imagine a situation where the CEO said, I'll tell you what, I know we just strip searched you a minute ago. I know you've been under consistent visual observation since then, but we want to do it again. You know why? Because we can. This court would never countenance such behavior because that would be a clear violation of bodily integrity and privacy. And so being in jail doesn't strip a person of their expectation of privacy writ large. It strips them of their expectation of privacy only to the extent necessary, according to the jail, to maintain safety and good order. And that is why we let the jail listen to the calls and record the calls, but not why we let them share. And that gets me to my second point, which is about the rule from Hempel and whether or not it's different. Because in Hempel, we were talking about sharing between garbage collectors and law enforcement. In Stott, between doctors and nurses and law enforcement. And here we're talking about between one branch of law enforcement and another branch of law enforcement. And I'd like to argue that it's no different, and here's why, or at least it's not meaningfully different. Take Hempel. Imagine a situation where because of civil unrest or because a neighborhood was particularly dangerous, garbage collectors said to the local police, listen, we need an escort to go into that neighborhood. We want you to effectively do a ride along with us as we collect trash. Well, the rule in Hempel wouldn't then allow those police officers to rummage through the curbside garbage of New Jerseyans because their expectation of privacy wouldn't allow it. In Stott, what we said is people who are in these state hospitals understand that nurses and doctors and orderlies might come into their room to keep them safe, but they're not expecting law enforcement to rummage through. Now imagine, and this actually takes no imagination, this is, I believe, true, that state hospitals have security guards, and those security guards are not contract employees, but in fact they're police officers who work for Health and Human Services. That they guard the front door and make sure visitors who come in don't have guns or contraband does not mean that they then have the right to search a person's room. Under well-established New Jersey jurisprudence, we allow the idea that there might be a reasonable expectation as to one person and not as to another. And when we allow jail officials to listen to phone calls, it is only for a limited purpose, and that purpose is to maintain safety and order in the facility. My last point, which is about why nothing but a warrant will protect the privacy interests implicated here. We have to start from the first principle, which is that phone calls are incredibly communicative. They reveal associations. They reveal a great deal of personal information. Now, that's not a controversial point. That's been well established for half a century since Cass. And so the question is, should we allow access to them on something less than a warrant supported by probable cause? And this court has several times said, we're going to find an expectation of privacy in something like bank records or ISP records or utility records, phone records, but we're going to allow access to it on less than a warrant supported by probable cause. But in each of those cases, in McAllister, in Reed, in Domes, and even in Lunsford, what the court said was, we're going to allow access to it on a grand jury subpoena or in Lunsford on a court order because the information is not as private. We're not getting directly to the associational, directly to the communicative. It's only derivatively useful. For example, right, if you have a high utility bill, it might talk about your usage of various products or a high, like, for personal products I'm referring to. Bank records might buy, you know, might show that you've gone to a doctor, but it's not saying, talking about what you actually said to a doctor. Here we're talking about core communication, and this court has never allowed, and no court has ever allowed, as far as I know, core communication for which a reasonable expectation of privacy exists to be obtained on anything less than a warrant supported by probable cause.
Questions?
But there's more to it than just that it's consistent with our jurisprudence, which has never allowed it. It's also good policy. And that gets to, I think, the second point that Ms. Lehrer said she couldn't say loudly enough, and I'd like to say it loudly as well now, which is, I'm going to illustrate this by a story. I had a friend who worked for the public defender's office, and he was arguing a case, and the appellate judge said to him, it was a search and seizure case where they found a cache of guns in a trunk. And the judge said, without irony, I believe, I don't understand why we never, when the police look in the trunk, they never find a cache of Bibles. They always find a cache of guns. And of course, that misunderstands the exclusionary rule. Cases are only going to make it to appellate courts when there's contraband to be excluded. But here, we don't have Article 1, Paragraph 7 to protect gun runners. We have it to protect all New Jerseyans from harassment and invasions of their privacy. And what a rule that says there's no expectation of privacy does, or even one that allows it on a grand jury subpoena, is it says, jail, you record everything and just turn it all over to the prosecutor, not just for when there's witness intimidation or drug running or the things that Justice Solomon was talking about, but you also get it when the pretrial detainee says to his loved one, I can't take it in here anymore. I need to get out. If they offered me a plea deal of 4 years, I would take it. And that's information that, under the appellate division's opinion and the state's theory, the prosecutor's office would have carte blanche to receive. And if they needed a grand jury subpoena, which they had in this case, but are saying they weren't even required to have, they could get that because it would be reasonably related to an ongoing criminal investigation. That bar is so low. If we want to protect this critical communicative information, the only thing that will do it is a warrant supported by probable cause. Unless there are any other questions?
No.
Any questions? I'd like to thank the court for their accommodation and wish you all good health.
Mr. Liston.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Simply put, the appellate division's decision in this case is correct and should be affirmed. So what the appellate division recognized is that the trial court's legal conclusions and the defendant's arguments before this court are based on certain false distinctions. First, regarding the state and federal wiretap acts, the defendants, as the court heard, concede that the calls were lawfully recorded by the jail, and yet argue that in order to obtain copies of those lawfully made recordings from the jail that made them, the prosecutor's office needs to obtain a judicial wiretap order. And this argument is, of course, premised on a false distinction between correctional officers and other law enforcement officers. But New Jersey's Wiretap Act defines the term investigative or law enforcement officer to include any government officer empowered by law to conduct investigations or make arrests for any offense enumerated in the Wiretap Act. It's also defined to include prosecutors. And our statutes also provide that county correctional police officers are, quote, empowered to act as officers for the detection, apprehension, arrest, and conviction of offenders against the law. So for purposes of the Wiretap Act, any distinction between an officer at a county jail and an officer at a prosecutor's office is just a false one. And it's interesting that the defendants cite the Seventh Circuit cases of Amati v. Woodstock in support of their arguments, because there Judge Posner approved of the routine recording of phone lines at a police station. So when you think about it, under the defendant's theory, a person could be arrested, charged, detained at a police station, and the police station could record those phone calls, and the prosecutor's office could, of course, obtain recordings of those phone calls, because under this court's jurisprudence, any discovery in the possession of a local police department is considered to be in the possession of the prosecutor's office. And yet, when that same detainee is transferred to the county jail, the jail can record those calls, and yet the prosecutor's office, in order to obtain copies of those recordings, would have to obtain the judicial wiretap order. Well, the state submits, Your Honor, that's an absurd result, and this did not interpret the Wiretap Act to allow such a result. And nor should this court adopt the defendant's reasoning regarding the constitutional arguments made. Again, the defendants concede that the inmates had no reasonable expectation of privacy in the recording of their calls with respect to the correctional officers, but argue that there is a distinction to be made and that they did have a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to the prosecutor's office. But again, our statutes provide that correctional officers and prosecutors are all law enforcement officers. And law enforcement agencies are encouraged and in certain cases required to share information regarding criminal activity with other law enforcement agencies. So the claim that the prosecutor's office conducted an unconstitutional search by issuing a grand jury subpoena to another law enforcement agency and receiving those recordings, again, it's just based on a false distinction between different categories of law enforcement officers. And the other false distinction that the defendants are trying to make is between pretrial detainees and convicted inmates, suggesting that a pretrial detainee has a greater privacy interest than a convicted inmate. But that's a distinction that our constitutional jurisprudence does not and should not recognize. If anything, a pretrial detainee's expectation of privacy in his phone calls is less reasonable because there's a greater risk that a detainee who has not yet been proven guilty will use the phone to obstruct the criminal justice process by directing people on the outside to hide or to destroy evidence, or, as occurred in the case before the court now, to tamper with witnesses. And one of the main goals of the recently enacted Criminal Justice Reform Act is to prevent the obstruction of justice by pretrial detainees. And that public policy has to be taken into account when this court considers whether the privacy right asserted is one that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable. Especially when, whereas in these cases, where the detainees were expressly told that their calls were going to be recorded and monitored. So the appellate division recognized all this, and it issued a very well-reasoned decision, and the state is just asking that this court affirm the decision of the appellate division, and the state will take any questions that the court may have.
Thank you, Mr. Liston. Ms. Hunt.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to start off with the idea that this court has never endorsed the kind of interagency blockade that's being suggested here. The line that they suggest should be drawn between one law enforcement agency and another is simply nonsensical. Law enforcement is law enforcement. And having any sort of role, whether it's under the Wiretap Act or under the Constitution, that turns on which law enforcement agency acts first, whether it's the corrections department that turns it over to the prosecutor, or whether they do it on request or on demand, any sort of rule that allows those sort of minutiae to be the determining factor, not only of one's rights under the statute, but under one's rights under the Constitution, simply doesn't make any sense. And that's because, in part at least, the question of whether there is an interception, just like whether there's been an invasion of privacy, those are questions that are both answered at the time of the phone call, at the time that the call is captured by the jail's recording system. So whether there's been an interception is defined by, as Your Honor mentioned before, under the law enforcement exception to the Wiretap Act, because that's kind of when everything gets set in stone, I guess, is the best way of putting it. Whether the call has been captured using any sort of electronic device used by law enforcement in the regular course is defined at that time. It's not defined later down the road when the prosecutor requests the information, or if and when corrections learns of information from those calls and then decides to turn it over to the prosecutor's office. And for similar reasons, whether there's been any sort of invasion of privacy, which obviously we suggest there is not, but whether there's been any sort of invasion is again determined at the time that the call is captured. Once one law enforcement agency has recorded a phone call, the privacy is over. And while defendants concede and we agree that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to the jail, that's really the dispositive question here, because once that call has been recorded by the jail, there is no more reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to another law enforcement agency. Because no reasonable person would expect that once their information is in the hands of one law enforcement agency, it's not going to be shared with another. It's contrary to reason, it's contrary to the regulations that require the corrections department to turn over information if they learn of a crime. It's contrary to the idea of the state's Brady obligations. The idea that there is this sort of line in the sand drawn between one agency and another is simply contrary to everything that this court has used in the past, even in the context of the third-party cases. In all of the third-party cases, it's not one law enforcement agency turning it over to another. It's information that's in the hands of a private agency, whether it's garbage collectors or a bank or a phone company or an internet service provider, then turning that information over to law enforcement. And in those sorts of cases, the interests are different because while one might not expect that a private company will share that information with law enforcement, that sort of reason doesn't apply when the information is already and immediately in the hands of law enforcement. And I want to address the two of the examples that Amica suggested. And the first is the Netflix example, and this is an example of exactly that principle. Well, I might not expect Netflix to turn over, a history of everything that I've watched on Netflix. That's because it's Netflix, not because it's a law enforcement agency. If I know that my viewer data or any other sort of information is in the hands of one law enforcement agency, there's not that same sort of expectation that it won't be in the hands of another. And then second, I want to turn to the strip search example, and it's not an area that I think is particularly relevant here, but I do just want to point out that it's those sorts of examples simply aren't applicable here, because in the case of a prosecutor going into a jail and asking the jail to conduct a first strip search or a subsequent strip search, that is a new invasion that is not similar to the issue here. Here there is no new invasion when the prosecutor obtains the information, because the information has already been essentially turned over to law enforcement. So there isn't that same sort of, there isn't a separate invasion of privacy, and again, there's no privacy, but there is no separate kind of invasion that occurs like would occur in a subsequent search. Unless your honors have any questions, I do just want to point out that I want to turn back to the Wiretap Act, I guess, and just address the fact that the prosecutor's office's receipt of the phone call is not a separate interception, both because it's not an interception as defined under the act, and because that sort of subsequent turning over is not doesn't use the devices that are mentioned that define what an interception is, but also because the call, as it's already been recorded, is not a wire communication that's protected by the Wiretap Act. And unless your honors have any questions, I just want to stress that the Appellate Division really got this one right. They addressed each of these arguments and recognized that our courts and federal courts have all sort of recognized that this is not there's no violation of the Wiretap Act here, and there's no violation of privacy here, because as defendants concede, the information is already lawfully in the hands of the jail, and taking that second step to turn it over to the prosecutor's office is not a separate interception, it's not a separate invasion of privacy, and that sort of free flow of information is what's expected by a reasonable person, and what has been expected and kind of recognized by our courts as the standard course.
Ms. Hunt, just one question. If we were to adopt the position that this was not an intercept in light of the definitional language in Section 2, do we need to reach the exceptions in Section 4 and 17?
No, because once you recognize that this is not an interception based on that based on the language in Section 2, it takes this entirely out of the Wiretap Act's kind of realm, I guess. Once it's recognized that that's not an interception, the rest of the Act doesn't apply, because it. For example, in Section 17, it makes clear that when it limits the authority to disclose, it's doing so for communications that are required as authorized under the Act, and that's simply not the case once it's kind of taken out of that definition.
Questions, anyone? Thank you, Ms. Lehrer, rebuttal.
Yes, briefly. Sorry, I have to stand. I don't know how to argue without standing. I'm going to make two brief points. The first is I just briefly want to distinguish why this law enforcement cooperation is different than the other kinds of law enforcement cooperation we're usually shown. Generally, when let's say the New Jersey police and the Pennsylvania police are sharing information, they're really sharing two types of information. Either publicly available information, I just saw this guy's car on the highway, right? We're both looking for him. Or they're sharing information that one of them has gotten lawfully through judicial process. So the veil of privacy has already been pierced through procedures we're comfortable with as a state. This is different because obviously these calls are not publicly available, and the way the privacy has been pierced is through the special institutional needs of the jail. It's a special narrow exception. So unlike usually when this court's discussion in Malika about how and when we're comfortable using information gotten from other jurisdictions, usually it's according to standards, judicial process that we're all comfortable with. And if we're not, if the state of New Jersey was asking the feds to do something that the state of New Jersey knew it could not get away with, like searching garbage, for instance, then this court would suppress the evidence because we still need to meet our constitutional minimum. So similarly, the prosecutor's office trying to leverage the jail for the special kind of information it only has special access to is inappropriate.
But is that our case? I mean, is that our case, Ms. Lehrer? Because there was no request here. I know you're not taping Mr. Jackson's phone calls, but we'd like you to start because we think there might be some evidence of witness tampering. That's not what happened here. That's a different case.
No, what happened is the prosecutor's office was investigating something entirely separate.
I understand how it happened.
Can't have every phone call. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I understand how it came about, but I think the analogy to your comment would be a situation where, the, for whatever reason, the jail is not taping anybody's phone calls, but the prosecutor's office calls up and says, there's one of your pretrial detainees that we'd like you to start taping the calls. That's not the case we have here.
Sure, and I think that would obviously be very disturbing, but the point that I'm trying to make is that the prosecutor's office knows generally to get phone calls, it needs a warrant, and it's saying to this other entity, hey, you have special needs, abilities to get access to this very private information. Can you give it to us when we couldn't otherwise get it? The second point I want to make is that the Attorney General's office is focusing on interception only and saying there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in your calls once they've been intercepted, but clearly you have a reasonable expectation of privacy for your private information not to be shared. Otherwise, it could be posted on the internet. Otherwise, prosecutors' offices could do anything they want with any of this information once a single law enforcement agency has it. These phone calls are private, and while the detainees and their loved ones are offering a window into these calls to a certain law enforcement agency to say, after that, you never have any claim that anything you say on these thousands of calls that we can get without any process whatsoever is not private anymore is really bewildering.
I understood their argument to be that the privacy question should be evaluated in terms of law enforcement to law enforcement, not suggesting you could post it online. Did you hear it differently?
I don't see a reason why, logically and principally, that would actually have to be the case once you say there's no privacy interest here anymore. And I do think the New York Court of Appeals in Johnson, which I said in my brief, there's a concurrence by a justice there that says it's very concerning if you say there's no reasonable expectation of privacy. Can the prosecutor's office listen to the calls, find out that a detainee is having an affair, get his wife in there, play her the calls, and then get her to flip and cooperate because she's so upset? So even if you take the specter of the internet away from kind of this dissemination, there's a lot of ways this information could be disseminated that do violate people's expectations of privacy, even pretrial detainees. So without some sort of limit on who can access these calls and when and what they can do with it, the suggestion that it's all fair game once it's out there to a law enforcement agency is very concerning.
Thank you.